Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 25th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Daryl Trimieux. Today's session number is 6 and is titled, I'm Okay, You're Okay, Not Racial Pluralism and Justice. Let's listen in.
Since like Lutherans, but not quite Lutherans, but it's good to be here. Title of this session is I'm Okay, You're Okay, Not. Okay, and what I'm trying to do is to capitalize a bit on a book that was written about 1984 or so, a bestseller list, I'm Okay, You're Okay, which had nothing to do with racial relations, but had a lot to do with the identity problems of modern day Americans. I'd like to share with you a reading of scripture from the Acts of the Apostles, the second chapter, with regard to the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, starting with the second chapter, the fifth verse. Now they were staying in Jerusalem, God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. When they heard this sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment, because each one heard them speaking in his own language. Utterly amazed, they asked, are not all these men who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hears them in our own native language? Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and the parts of Libya near Cyrene. Visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. Amazed and perplexed, they ask one another, what does this mean? Well, a lot of people have asked that question, what did that mean? I would suggest to you that we can contrast that passage of scripture with the story in scripture of the Tower of Babel. If you remember, in that particular story, you had people who were ethnically similar. You had a homogeneous society that decided to build this tower towards the heavens as a sign of their magnificence, their culture, and their competence, as a sign of their civilized state. We all know how that story ended. It ended in confusion, in which God intervened in the world in such fashion as to actually put a divine sanction upon really homogeneity. Because after Babel, the word even Babel was similarly affiliated, people lost the ability, in the story at least, to communicate to each other. They dispersed into ethnicity. Here you have the opposite image. You have the manifestation of ethnicity. You have notions of race and ethnicity. You have Jews from all over the world who are born in different parts of the world, who come together in Jerusalem, who hear the gospel, but they hear it in a diversity of tongues. What I'd like to suggest to you, in answer to the question that they raise, what does this mean, is rather that you have the divine approval on pluralism, multiculturalism, and ethnic diversity. I would suggest to you that what Christianity finally represents is a divine approval of God's diversity. So that what finally makes us human is the ability of each of us to praise God, to understand God's message, to respond to God's leading, and hopefully to see each other as created in the image of God and as children of God. But that is a celebration of difference, not a celebration of sameness. And I think a lot of people are very worried in modern American society because they say, well, multiculturalism and pluralism, religious, ethnic, racial, and otherwise, will be the death of this nation. And part of what the complaint that underlines those complaints is a mythic past, a golden past in which this country was homogeneous. Well, that has never been the actual reality of this country. In terms of even the European settlers, you had a struggle in this country among a number of Europeans. The Dutch and the British fought over Manhattan. The French and the English fought over North America and Canada. The Spanish fought everybody in terms of the southern borders, and the Spanish and the Portuguese had to go to Rome to try and divide up Central and South America. So that there's always been a pluralism here. From before 1619, actually, you've had the Spanish and with the Moors who came and investigated part of this country in terms of St. Augustine and the West, particularly things like the establishment of Santa Fe in the 16th century before the Mayflower landed. And before the Mayflower landed, you had the importation of African slaves into this country. And of course, this was not a country that was barren of human beings upon the invasion of the country by European immigrants. Namely, the whole country was populated with natives who had themselves migrated approximately 30,000 years earlier from Asia. So that there is no mythic, there's only a mythic past of this country in which there is homogenization. So I think what we have to confess initially in talking about the issue of racism and racial pluralism is that this country has never been, in terms of its establishment, a country based upon the notion of equality. The Puritans and all of the settlers in this country came to this country with the notion that they had a superior civilization and or superior culture, and indeed bent about that to impose that upon other people. So that as we move towards equality, as we move towards egalitarianism, we are moving into new territory. We're not moving in to restore something that previously existed here because it never did. Particularly in North America, in what we call the United States of America, to be a full citizen meant to be generally a European male, over the age of 21, and to vote and to run for office, a European male over the age of 21 who also owned property in freehold. Okay. And then you were considered to be a full-fledged citizen. And that, of course, limited the numbers of people who really were full-fledged citizens in this country. It eliminated women, it eliminated Native Americans. For the most part, it eliminated even free African Americans. And it eliminated a lot of white males who were over the age of 21 but did not own real property. Numbers of Europeans came over here as indentured servants. Well, I'd like to share with you a quotation from Manning Marable with regard to racism. It's from a very good book, which I would recommend to you, though it is somewhat expensive, Moral Issues of Christian Response. In fact, our own Larry Rasmussen has one or two essays in here, and it's a very good text. Manning Marable now teaches at Columbia, and the essay I'm quoting from is The Rhetoric of Racial Harmony. And it won't be too long, so I hope we won't lose too many folks as I read this to you. America's society is more thoroughly integrated today in terms of race relations than at any point in its entire history. Since 1964, the number of black elected officials has increased from barely 100 to 7,000. The number of African Americans enrolled in colleges and universities has quadrupled. The number of black-owned banks and financial institutions has increased tenfold. The percentage of African Americans in the middle class and professions has significantly expanded. Perhaps the most striking changes in public perceptions of race have occurred in popular culture, social institutions, and the media. American music, theater, public education, sports, and the arts are now heavily influenced by the rhythms and the patterns of African-American life. Black images in commercial advertisements are commonplace. Blacks remain underrepresented in the ownership and management of cultural and social institutions, but are nearly omnipresent as employees and prominent public representatives, particularly in the state sector. Well, reading that quote to you would give you the impression that the rest of the essay would say that essentially the problems of racism in our country have been overcome. But that is indeed not what the conclusion that Marable comes to. One of the things that Marable points out is that the vast increase in black elected officials has not been able to be translated into, in particular, significant political and economic power. Now wait. Not sure what that bell is for, but it sounds interesting.
10:45 bus is leaving.
Oh, okay. For instance, let me just call this table to your attention. This is slightly dated, but nevertheless, I think is revelatory. Okay, in particular, I'd like you to take a look at that second layer of statistical materials. And I'll read it out in case you can't read it, because I realize the limitations of overheads. In 1970, African Americans, in what you would call the lowest fifth in terms of economic class, earned roughly, and we're talking about families here, $9,054 in comparison to European American or white families of $16,756. In other words, black families earned 54 cents for every dollar that European American families earned. And in terms of the second fifth, $15,983 compared to $26,588, that's 60 cents on a dollar. The third fifth, $24,000 to $35,068. The fourth, $35,000 to $48,073%. And then finally, in the top 5%, $56,000 to $75,074 on the dollar. So in no area in terms of class structures did African Americans earn European Americans earned in 1970. Well, let's see what happens in 1980. Now, you have to understand, 1980 is fairly significantly after the Civil Rights Act, Title VII, and a lot of what you call your affirmative action changes. In the lowest, again, fifth, African Americans earned $8,511. Compared to whites of $16,238, in other words, 52 cents on out of every dollar. In other words, there's a loss there. Instead of gaining ground, there is a loss of ground. Similarly, the next category, it's 57 cents on a dollar. The third category maintained even, 68 cents. But in the upper categories, there is some gain. 76 cents on the dollar, 79 cents on the dollar. One of the things that should disturb everybody is that in terms of constant dollars, which is what the person did who drafted this particular graph, the wages of all families in America fell. They did not rise. So that what you have, even though we know inflation did not fall, but in fact took off with the, you know, during the Carter era and since then, is that you've had continued falling in the last 20 years of American wages across all ethnic categories, which is something for another one of my classes to talk about in terms of economic problems in our country, but should give you some pause. Well, what is the importance of any of this? I think what the importance of this is to realize that although a lot of things have changed in American society, a lot of things have remained the same. And I don't want to talk just about economic problems, because I think the problems are larger than just economics. For instance, there's a significant change in American society with regard to our public school systems. And indeed, I think they reflect changing housing patterns. Around the turn of the century, or slightly before, to really be civilized meant to live in a city, so that your quintessential civilized European American, the person we think of as being at the top rungs of society, would be the man or woman about town in a large cosmopolitan area, the sophisticated, the cultured individual, the person who lived in a city, went to the arts and supported the arts, was a patron of the arts, was a patron of society, a philanthropist, but was an urban person. Now, essentially, what we have in modern-day America is kind of an odd donut. We have a kind of white frosting on the donut, and we have a center. And particularly, this is most easily seen in public schools, in which ethnicities are, in essence, oftentimes trapped within urban areas, where there has been an out-migration of jobs to the white frosting on the donut, and an in-migration of the problems to what we call now the inner cities. So that this donut effect takes in consideration changes in migration of both jobs and patterns of people. In other words, post-1945, you had the creation of better highways, and with that, the creation of suburbs. And now, the image of desirability in America is to have the four-bedroom or more home in the suburbs, away from the city, and the subtext is away from ethnicities, other people of other races. And this is particularly true in terms of school. You can see it right here in this Chelan County. The town of Manson, and we don't really think of this as an Hispanic part of the country, is about 50% Hispanic, but the school system is about 70% Hispanic in terms of public schools. So that what we have going on is both the elected increase of number of officials that are African Americans or Hispanics or other ethnicities who are elected, but the institution of what is known as de facto segregation. In other words, there is intentional segregation of a variety of people based upon notions of racism, so that people want to keep certain kinds of communities intact and away from other people. Which brings me to my questions, and then I think I'm going to open this up for everybody to complain, criticize, or illuminate as God directs you. How would you describe yourself, racially speaking? Somebody asked you to do that. You're filling out a form for the government. You know, you put your name, your sex, then you look under the categories of race. How do you describe yourself, racially speaking?
As in, like, white, black, Hispanic, white, or other?
Yeah.
White.
All right, so you would mark okay. White. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyone else? Everybody just kind of goes in those categories.
Yeah. I don't like the categories, but that's what I label.
That's generally what's on the form, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, there is a reason for that, and the reason essentially deals with an inability to distinguish between kind of socially constructed notions of race and socially constructed notions of ethnicity. In other words, take the years 1848 and 1849. In those years in Ireland, you had the Great Potato Famine. In that famine, over 1 million Irish starved to death. In that year, about a million and a half Irish migrated. Over a million of them migrated to the United States alone. Okay, so that most people of Irish ancestry can trace their ancestry here to that great out-migration from Ireland. Well, now in Ireland, they were somewhat a subjugated part of the British Commonwealth. Okay, so that whether you were in Northern Ireland or in Southern Ireland, you didn't say, "I'm British." You said, "I'm Irish," if you were born there of Irish parents, of course. And if you were born on the island of Britain, you would consider yourself to be British, okay? But a funny thing occurs with the conquest of this country. You have people who leave Europe with clear ethnic identities. Some are Irish, some are English, some are Spanish, some are French, some are German, some are Dutch, that have real countries with real language, you know, like the Netherlands or Germany or France or Italy. But when they arrive upon these shores, all of a sudden, everybody's constrained, for the most part, to speak English, but to describe themselves not as English or not even as German American, Europeans become white. But over on the continent of Europe, there isn't a white land. Okay, from which, you know, white ancestors may have migrated. There are ethnicities on one side of the Atlantic. There is only a physical description on the other side. So that you get into what we call phenotypology, how you look, how you describe yourselves. You know, how much melanin do you have in your skin, therefore how darkly will it tan? Whether your hair is kinky and curly or straight, whether your eyelids have certain kinds of folds in them that does not have them, so that your eyes appear to be round. We get into descriptions of people rather than explications or descriptions of cultures, of ways people understand themselves. So that the Irish come over here, and sometimes they still speak Gaelic, but they spoke English and Gaelic back in Ireland. But in terms of their social status, instead of simply being now and all for all time despised Irish, they are somewhat despised here for at least a period of time. There is a transition in which Irish, to be Irish and Catholic, is not to be a high status in this country. But nevertheless, they're white. And so they come into a pecking order, a hierarchy, in which they're not any longer at the bottom. Okay? They may not be at the top, but they're not at the bottom. And of course, as time goes by, and as being Roman Catholic is no longer such a great, disability, social disability, and being Irish is no longer being a disgrace, particularly either because you change your name or because the Irish begin to get power, then the privileges of being white, namely the change between having indentured servants and going to a system of slavery, really come to the fore, in which then to be fully an American citizen, you just simply have to go by the old phrase, which I guess probably you're too young to remember, but was popular during my era, namely that if you were a full citizen, you'd say, "I'm free white in 21. How many of you remember that phrase? Okay, most folks who are my age or older do. I mean, that was quite popular. And what that meant was, hey, I can do what I want in this society as long as I don't break the law. You know, I am fully free. I'm fully empowered. Well, what I would suggest to you is that the form of racism that prevailed on this continent was what is known as white supremacy. The notion that God created people not necessarily equal. In fact, it's a theological statement. God is not quite capable of making people who are fully equal. Some people simply are better than other people, and that depends upon how God makes them look, so that if they have a certain kind of phenotype, pale skin, straight hair, thin lips, aquiline noses, these people are better than other people who are more tanned, curly-haired, thick-lipped, in other words, different than people at a certain kind of hierarchy. And what we have tried to work on, at least in terms of African Americans, what we have tried to work out of from that point is that problem of white supremacy. Because, in fact, it is based upon certain kind of genetic factors that are immutable within one's lifetime. Okay. How many of you have heard of a recent book by Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein called The Bell Curve? Okay, two people. All right. The Bell Curve is a form of pseudoscience that was popular in the 19th century that came out within the last couple of years that maintains that in America, for instance, there are a certain number of people that can be described scientifically as members of one race, namely African Americans, members of another race, namely European or white people, and members of a kind of third category, namely Asians. And the book maintains that the Stanford-Binet IQ tests and other kinds of IQ tests reveal, and this is what's very interesting, that Asians are intellectually, in terms of IQ, superior to European Americans, that European Americans are at least 15 points superior to African Americans, and therefore has a hierarchy of intelligent quotients. What's most interesting is that the book argues essentially that these differences are not caused primarily by any historical factors, by any social factors, by any nurturance factors, by any opportunity factors, by any cultural factors, but are essentially scientifically genetic and immutable. Thus, the authors come to the conclusion that we should deal away with all kinds of compensatory programs, Head Start, affirmative action, or anything else, because the failure of African Americans and other supposedly less intelligent, and I guess there's no other way of putting it, species, is immutable. You know, the argument goes something along these lines. You can put a ribbon around a rat, but it doesn't make him a gerbil. You know. In other words, government cannot compensate for what is innate. Okay, nor can the rat tie a ribbon around its neck and declare itself to be a gerbil or a hamster because it's immutable. Well, that particular book has been lambasted by all of your anthropologists and basically all of your ethnologists as being essentially nonsensical, scientifically speaking. And the reason for that is that, you know, ethnographers, ethnologists, and anthropologists have come to the conclusion that whatever was true in the past, in terms of Cro-Magnons and other forms of humanoids, only one species exists on the earth, Homo sapiens sapiens, and that therefore there is only one human race. Thus, until we run into Sasquatch or E.T., we're stuck with the fact that there's just one human race. And that, in fact, there are no scientifically verifiable, notable differences in intelligence or any other human faculties between races. Thus, the notion of white supremacy, from a scientific point of view, falls into the category of pseudoscience. Now, I've done a lot of talking, and I guess what I want to do is say a couple of other things as suggestions for ways to work our way out of the problems we have. And I want to talk primarily culturally rather than politically today. One of the things I would suggest to help people think more clearly about the issue of race is to use race in terms of how Marable has described it as describing just one race, the human race, but not to move towards a notion of color blindness, but to move towards an embrace of ethnic diversity and difference. Thus, one of the things that I think would make this country a better country, that would help Christians to learn to love and accept each other, would not be an attempt to ignore difference or to downplay difference, or even merely to tolerate difference, but to learn more about difference and to learn to embrace difference. And part of this, I'll admit, comes out of my own socialization. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, in an ethnically diverse community. The house I grew up in was next door to some African Americans from the South, traditionalists. On the other side, there were some Polish Americans. Across the street were some Russian Jews. The people who lived over them were German Americans who didn't like them because they were Jews. The people up the street were Greek, and on the other side, some of the other people were Italian. And so it was really a blend of ethnicities. And it was a blessing for me because, unlike a lot of Americans, I began with the notion that there are a lot of different people. And that who a person was not so immediately apparent upon just looking at their face. That in fact, if you listened to them and you understood how they understood themselves, how they understood the world, you did not necessarily agree, but you could see that there were genuine differences, and yet at the same time, you could see how in many respects we were all alike. So, what I'm going to try and suggest is that we try and resist non-scientific and I think culturally and socially non-progressive or retrograde categories such as white and black and try and get people to discover and celebrate their ethnicity. So, in fact, if you're a German American, a Scottish American, French American, or whatever hyphen, I celebrate you. I say, you know, praise be to God for diversity. Because when we describe ourselves as that, or if you're Heinz 57, you can, you know, there's still categories as in I'm a European American. You follow me? Because there is a real Europe. There is a real European culture. There is a real European civilization. And those things can be celebrated without necessarily, again, being hierarchical. You follow me? And that can be played out in culture and even finally work its way into public policy. As in, for instance, I really like American jazz, and that tends to be African American. I like John Coltrane. I like Dizzy Gillespie. I like Miles Davis. I like the music they've produced. But I don't have a hierarchy in terms of culture. That's my particular preference. If you share it, we can go put on some music and jam. If you don't, you can still appreciate it, or you can ignore it. You see what I'm saying? But my celebration of it is not dependent upon you. And your celebration of whatever music you like, whether it's, you know, the three B's, Brahms, Bach, and Beethoven, or whether it's country and Western, or whatever else it is, or whatever it might be in art, or any of the other arts, stands on its own. You don't need me to join you, but hopefully you don't mind if I do. You know, because on St. Patty's Day, I might like a little green beer. I might want some corned beef and cabbage. And I might want to tip my hat and show some respect to Irish culture. And I think in doing that, I don't do the Irish any harm. And in fact, I think what we do is we knit together real notions of being Americans. Namely, that we're not one kind of homogenized chunk of cheddar cheese or anything else, but that somehow we are alike and yet somehow we are different. And so that's what I'd lay before you, is to again think of Acts 2 and realize that we don't have to all speak the same language. That God has a way of intervening in our lives, of bringing us together, but it does help to learn of each other, okay? And to appreciate difference. Now, I've talked a very long time, but hopefully, in an interesting, nobody's fallen asleep yet, so I'm going to give you folks a chance to share some of your ideas or criticisms. Yes?
The one thing that I think the church has yet to do and still is working on it now, in some of the communities, like in Washington, D.C., Jesus has been viewed closer to origins, is that we fail to recognize church history and a diversity of church history. For somehow Jesus has become a European Christian, and in fact, to go back to the history, he's probably more or less, first of all, Jewish, of course, and therefore going to, if you were to physically represent that would be considerably different. And not only that, if you go to the Sabras in Israel, you're going to realize that Jesus was quite dark, likely. And also, if we go through the history, you got the Ethiopian Jews, we have the Ethiopian convert before Paul. I mean, you go through the whole history, and the European community was hit, in a sense, very late on with Christianity. So these notions of that we are literally rejecting the beginnings of our culture, the beginnings of our church culture, if we reject certain populations, because in fact the Ethiopians have been more Christian and Jewish for a longer time than we have.
Yeah, that's true.
And you know, things like that. And I think if the church would celebrate its history in the church and celebrate the diversity of how the church developed and how Jesus developed it, and also not concentrate on it, but rather celebrate it. In other words, a lot of people also like to focus on Jesus's maleness. And frankly, I have no idea why God made Jesus a male. It could be because as a female, he would have been unremarkable at his time. And perhaps that was the reason. So in other words, we don't know why Jesus is a male. So why celebrate that God is male? Because in fact, we have no idea. God has mother and father attributes.
Yeah, God is not male. Jesus is male.
Exactly. That's what I mean. But that's what happens.
Yeah.
But that's what happens. And I think we tend to put notions on as if there's some significance to all this, other than the celebrating of the diversity of the development.
Yeah.
The celebration of...
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, and I think you're right onto something there. Herodotus describes Jews as being almost indistinguishable from Ethiopians.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read Acts, you notice that Paul begins to be beaten because someone, a Roman, thinks that Paul's an Egyptian.
Yeah.
And of course, this is a time before the great influx of Arab blood into Egypt, because this is before Islam,
mm-hmm.
When North Africa is essentially what we would now call black. It seems to me clear that Jews of that era would not, in terms of phenotype, would not look like Europeans. That, again, also, as you pointed out, is a historical accident. You know,
mm-hmm.
God finally had to come in the flesh somewhere and just happened not to be in Europe. And it's also true, the earliest, most powerful church was the North African church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the church that went across Europe and in particular Christianized the Irish, who then Christianized Northern Europe. So that Christianity spreads from Palestine and North Africa northward, rather than from Europe southward. And in fact, one of the strange things in terms of African-American Christianity, of course, is that my ancestors who came from West Africa were not, for the most part, Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Because North Africans did not spread Christianity, for the most part, to West Africa,
mm-hmm.
where my ancestors came from. But to other parts of the world. Yeah, I think that would be helpful. I met the Coptic Pope once, who, of course, was an Egyptian, and traced his apostolic succession right back to Mark, your first Coptic Pope. Of course, he was not a European. Right, no, great preacher, though. And he even gave me a signed book and everything, and I can always say I met the Pope and get everybody excited. And some people stay excited when I tell them it's a Coptic Pope, but some folks don't. But yeah, I think you're right on to something there. If people knew more church history, they would understand.
Church education books. In other words, don't have a white Jesus, a European Jesus hanging around the church. Have the various, no, I'm serious, have the true diversity of how it developed and how it spread. Otherwise, there's no appreciation that there's any difference from the culture you're in, and therefore, why should you have to, if you were to relate to Jesus, you have to relate to other cultures. And that may be a powerful tool. That may be a powerful tool. I have to come to learn and accept other cultures if I'm going to understand this Jesus of years ago. Because in fact, Jesus loves me even though I don't look like Jesus, even though I don't understand the culture necessarily he came out of. And that might be a powerful tool to say, I have to understand other cultures. I have to say, what is it like to be in that culture? Because I need to know more, because I know Jesus loves me, and I love Jesus very much as a little child, and then come to that development. I think that's missing in church education.
Now, that's a very good point, and that's something I think the African American church can share, because the representation of Jesus for us in terms of physical type was a Jesus that did not look like us, and yet we learned to love, again, as far as we understood at that time, a Jesus that did not look like us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's useful for everybody, because again, it's a historical accident that Jesus comes to, you know, one set of Jews at a certain point in history. Mm-hmm. You know, unless we had multiple Jesuses over the world at different points of time, you're going to finally wind up with just one. You know, and one is enough. You know, how many crucifixions do we need? Other comments, though? Or criticisms.
One of the comments I would want to raise is around the whole question of culture. Why, you know, why is skin such a big issue? And yet, I think for many of us today, it gets tied in with culture. And I wonder if you want to comment a little bit about like how important our cultures are to each of us and how we can't accept other cultures.
Well, I mean, the problem, I think, and I have to talk about racism as a form of discourse to really respond to that. Part of the difference between the modern world and the pre-modern world is in some respects a de-emphasis upon culture and a higher emphasis in the modern world upon scientific and sometimes pseudo-scientific categories. So that, you know, Philip of Macedonia conquers as much, and Alexander conquer as much as they can because they want to spread Hellenism. Not because they think, well, gee, we're white, we're Greek, hey, you know, we're better because of what we look like. You know, now they certainly had high notions of Greek culture, and they certainly had high hopes for imperialism and realized them. But, you know, you could have a Hellenized world, you see what I'm saying? And you could live in, I mean, just as I learned to speak English, I don't have to have blonde hair to speak English. Okay, so that Jesus, of course, speaks Aramaic and reads Hebrew and probably speaks Koine Greek because he lives in a Hellenized world. Mm-hmm. And Jesus doesn't have to change genetically and become Greek to be Hellenized. But I think the modern world in which you begin to have conquest during an age of the hierarchy, Linnaeus, classifying, for instance, animals in a different phylums and families and categories, Europeans utilized that structure of organization and tried to give it a scientific patina, so that, in fact, you know, European civilization also then has to be hierarchical. It can't simply be good civilization. It has to be the norm. And departures from it fall down on the scale. And that's where the problems come in. Because of the fact that, you know, there's problems with understanding Western civilization because, of course, the Greeks learned from Egyptians, again, Africans. So, you know, it's very difficult to, you know, you have to then torture your history because it's very difficult to say, well, the reason why we should conquer Africa and Asia and all that is because, again, in terms of a hierarchy, we're racially better, and also we're culturally better if you have to trace in your cultural line Africans. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? So then you began to have notions and some pseudo histories in which somehow Egyptians are Mediterranean people, which then makes them sound like, well, since there are European Mediterranean people like Greeks, and Italians, well, then Egyptians, of course, are European. So there's this. There's this a kind of a torture of history. Why is it important? Because the white man's burden, as Rudyard Kipling would put it, was based upon the notion of having a superiority. In other words, you can invade these other countries because they're benighted. If they're not benighted, but simply different, and if your culture is not better, but simply different, and if Christianity, in terms of, again, I'm talking about sociological terms, is simply one religion alongside another religion, then you have no moral impetus, warrant, or right to impose that upon other people. So that you have to promulgate on a vast scale a false social psychology that then will allow you to feel good about yourself as you go and kill people and rape people and take their land, and use that as part of the furnace for the development of Europe. And that's essentially what happened. So that, in fact, now you have problems throughout that imperial process. Because lo and behold, the people who are conquered do learn to speak French and Spanish and English. The last time, and I'll close on this and so more folks can speak. Last time I was in England, it was very interesting. I always think of beef eaters when I think of England. Stereotypical perhaps, but British people are British. They're pale skinned, thin-lipped, you have that image in your head. But when I went to Heathrow Airport, my bags were handled by West Indians, my reservations were handled by Sikhs, and my hotel stay was handled by Pakistanis, I began to say, where are all these white people? And of course you'd see some on the streets. When I went to Paris, when I went to the Sorbonne, the Louvre, to look at some of the paintings there, and saw most of the guards there, and a lot of the civil service offices are held by Francophile, either West Indians or Africans. What you find is that the chickens came home to roost. Some people did become convinced that, maybe Europe was a pretty good place to live. And there was an out-migration to Europe, so that now you have American-style, you would say, racial problems in Europe. And you have Germans who are unhappy that there's a lot of Turks there. But the Turks didn't come there like they did in the 14th and 15th centuries to conquer. These Turks came there to work. You see what I'm saying? And they fit into the German economy because they did jobs that a lot of Germans didn't want to do. And so now you do have a pretty large Turkish population there. Well, again, if there has to be hierarchies, and if to have any African blood is a disability, then you do have to erect hedges around those pure populations. Because really, if there are lower people, then you do have to engage in kind of eugenics. You have to preserve the superior people. And so that causes strife. That's why you have some of these freedmen and the Ku Klux Klan and others. There was a person over here.
Yeah. While you're in Europe, you asked earlier about the filling out the forms for the government, white, African-American, other. Did you notice how they were dealing with the influx of different races in Europe to Do they have anything like that over there?
You mean forms? I didn't look at that.
Yeah.
I would suspect that probably, that varies from European country to country, because some countries, I think, are more flexible on issues of race.
Mm-hmm.
I know the French, for instance, are really very big on in terms of their culture. If you really speak a good form of French, they'll wink at a lot of other things. Until particularly, a lot of it has to deal with numbers. So you have a lot of French who are concerned about the numbers of Moroccans and others. Some of it is because these people are Islamic, and some of it just simply has to do with the way they look, even though they speak perfectly good French. I think a lot of countries are struggling with it. But you can even see it now in a lot of your Olympic Games or your World Cup. You'll find teams representing the Netherlands and who come from formerly Dutch territories, who speak Dutch, know Dutch culture, but don't look like the little blonde haired, wooden shoe, finger in the dike image we have of the Dutch. These things change. I don't know if that answered your question. I tried, but other comments, yes.
I have a comment and then I kind of have a question. In the town where I'm from, there's a lot of Hispanics moving in. And it's basically because of it's an agricultural community, and I understand that. But it's like they have a totally different culture than we do, and they're not willing to try. I mean, that's what I perceive, just me, that they're not willing particularly to try. Some are, but on the whole, most of them are not really willing to try to meld into our community. You talk about all the cultures that come from Europe and other countries. I know when my grandparents came from, other country, European countries and came over, I mean, I remember growing up with the big deal that, you come here and you do your best and you learn the English language and you work hard and, you conform to this country.
Sure.
Type thing.
Sure.
Where visibly, we don't really particularly see that happening, from the Hispanic culture that's coming into our community now. There's a big emphasis on learning on everything is either English, and then right beside it, there's Spanish. It isn't like they are having to conform to learn the English language.
Sure, sure.
And there's lots of special classes going on in schools and stuff for the kids, and that's good, but you don't see it happening with the adults, like you saw with people coming from other parts.
They're
conform to the language.
Yeah, there are different, there are different forms of immigration. A lot of people forget, for instance, like founding fathers were immigrants, and also that Northern Europeans came to this country after, for instance, Spanish-speaking conquistadors. So you have a lot of Mexican Americans, 8, 9, 10 generations in, who speak, of course, perfectly good English, whose ancestors go back to Spanish land grants and were here before English-speaking people. And you, of course, have recent immigrants. Now, I understand your concern about that, because no one wants to see the extinction of their culture. And if you get a lot of people moving into your town that don't want to pick up any of your social cues, that don't want to carry on any of your traditions, that don't want to share in the replication of your world, that is a concern. And I don't mean to try and make light of that. The only thing I would suggest to you is that particularly your newer immigrants may not have at present an easy ability to do that. That they may not be, because there's differences in immigrants too. Take for instance your average Cuban American. Who are the Cubans who came here from Batista, Cuba? They were the Cubans, first of all, who had the right phenotype. Straight-haired, white-skinned Cubans. They were Cubans who had a lot of skill, a lot of education, and capital. And they didn't go disperse themselves throughout this country. They went to Florida and New York primarily. And they turned their very considerable skills into establishing themselves in this country and in this new world. And they did quite well. And I say hooray for, you know, for Cuban Americans. But a lot of immigrants don't come to this country out of that class. You see what I'm saying? Indeed, when we had Cubans that came out of a different class, Marielitos, you had a lot of Cuban Americans that didn't want them to come over because these were people who were not educated, who, and you had racism in Cuba, who had kinky hair and thick lips and darker skin, whom, you know, Cuban Americans would say, hey, we were happy when they were in Cuba. You see what I'm saying? And also a lot of them were part of a criminal element. No getting around that either. But in terms of your, in terms of what you're talking about, you know, the model before was to project the image again, and this is the concentration on the Mayflower. The American image of settlers goes around Thanksgiving, in which it's English settlers with friendly Indians who sit down to turkey and pumpkin and corn. Not Spanish-speaking people who were there 50 to 100 years before. You see what I'm saying? So that the notion as a norm has to be English. And hey, I speak English. My Spanish is very poor. And I think it does make it difficult to try and have, as the Swiss seem to have pulled off, you know, three or four languages that are almost covalent. You see what I'm saying? So I recommend the learning of English. And I would suggest to you that that over time, these immigrants will, in fact, speak English and celebrate a lot of English culture. But that does not get, that does not get around the fact that you see them as other, and they see themselves as other. And part of what they're trying to do to make it in this world is to preserve their culture. Because it's in that culture that we have our identity. And what they're afraid of, if they left El Salvador or Guatemala or Mexico or wherever, they're afraid of just being swallowed up and becoming nothing.
I thought they came here to become Americans.
Yeah, but see, to come here to become American does not mean to come here and celebrate only English ancestry and culture.
Not lose their identity.
Every nationality that came from Europe, they switched, it seemed like every time there was an influx of one first particular nationality, they were looked down on for a while and made fun of and everything.
Generally.
They had a hard time. But in the early days, nothing was done for them by the government like it is now for the Spanish.
Well, that I hate to disagree with you, but that's not true. Because what happened in this country where Europeans were given land. And in an agricultural society, that was the main thing you needed, was good arable land. And also, I hate to disagree with you, but there was always a lag. You know, if you got somebody from another country, that first generation, it took them a while to learn to speak English. And in second and third generations, yes, they did learn English.
But they did learn. I mean, they worked to learn it.
Yeah, but see, you still, what you have in this country is you still have first generation people coming over.
Yeah, well, I wasn't thinking of land. I was thinking of the language, I guess. They help in learning the language and things like that.
I also, what area of the nation do you live in, just for interest's sake? Do you live in the Midwest or the East
Coast?
If you lived in the East Coast, there might be a different viewpoint of how things are set up. Many of the neighborhoods in the East Coast still maintain their ethnic identity to the point of, for many generations, if you go into Little Italy, New York, you'll hear mostly Italian. If you go into other neighborhoods, like Little Cuba in Florida, you'll hear very little English spoken on the street.
That's right.
And so some places are still set up in neighborhoods which not only celebrate the culture, they continue to. In Philadelphia, the Italian section is unbelievably Italian. And the same thing occurs. There hasn't been the melding that you think has occurred in the Midwest and other areas. There's been more of the...
Yes, yes and no. I mean, there's still a lot of Chicago,
Right.
That's Bohemian. There's still a lot of Chicago that's Polish.
So there are some people, and there's some people who grow up, so Lawrence Welk was born in this country. And he sounds like he was born in Europe, in Germany.
Yeah.
And I'm serious, because he never spoke English the beginning of his life. He grew up in North Dakota. And so I think that kind of thing continues to happen. We just don't see it as much for cultures that don't look as different.
Well, I think that...
Or act as different, perhaps.
In the Midwest, where I grew up, there was a lot of Scandinavians, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they tended to go maybe where the first ones came, mm-hmm. they knew them, and they wanted to live near them. And so they ended up, a lot of them, congregating in a certain area. That's probably the way it's been with all nationalities.
Now, I agree with you there. I mean, people do tend to go where they can make that cultural gap. That jump is the shortest jump.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, most Cubans went to Florida, where there already was a Cuban population, even before Castro, because they had perhaps family, or certainly, if not family, at least people who spoke the language that could help them make that cultural jump. I mean, this woman in the back, I feel for you, and I understand that your difficulty with it. You have your sunglasses on, I don't know your name. At the same time, what I'm saying is that has always been the reality in this country. There's always been a time when people didn't fit in, when there was resistance to assimilation, and that the feelings against that now have also been there. There's been resentments in the past. As I said before, the Irish were not admired when they first came here. This gentleman we haven't heard from.
It's interesting, ethical kind of thing, this cultural clash. I have a fourplex, and I rented a fourplex to a Hispanic family that was a mother and father, and they had three children when I rented to them, and then a fourth one appeared. And then before long, they invited another couple and three more children to live with them, who were newly arrived in the community and needed a place to stay. And I said, I admire their willingness to share. And I had three other tenants in the other units screaming their head off at this circus that was going on. And, you know, what do I do as a landlord trying to manage?
Good ethical question. You know, I think there are some laws in terms of human habitation. I don't think that Christian morality requires you to break the law. Just as in, for instance, you know, there are Muslim countries where polygamy prevails. You know, I don't think you have to rent your unit to somebody who has four and five wives simply because you don't want to be a moral or cultural imperialist and don't want to break up their family. You know, I think that, yeah, people can bring their culture with them, but I don't think that every aspect of their culture should be able to be imposed upon people in a new land. I mean, you do give something up when you do leave the land of your birth and immigrate to another country. I mean, there is something to when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I know one of the good things the British did in terms of imperialism is to more or less stamp out Thuggeeism, which was a form of religion in which ritual strangulations were part of the worship. And while I believe in religious freedom, I'm not going to fight for somebody to come over here to roam around my country strangling people with silk handkerchiefs. You know, there's a limit to difference that we can accept. You see what I'm saying? And so for you, I mean, if in fact the occupancy laws do not allow you to rent your property in that fashion, I wouldn't suggest you go against the laws of your county or whatever. Or even if, you know, even if you've come to the conclusion, having good experience in renting units, that, you know, 10 children in three rooms is going to destroy your property, you see what I'm saying? I don't think you have to just say, well, hey, you know, my property's just gone. You see what I'm saying? Because they'll still need a place to live even after your property is destroyed. You see, that won't change the fact that people need places to live. I don't know if that answered. I tried, but this gentleman over here had a.
I was going to comment that you started out asking a question about how people fill out forms, you know, white or whatever.
Sure.
And it seems to me that a critique of immigration history would be that there were generations of European Americans who came here and lost their cultural identity that contributes to the very problems you're addressing today, where if those same persons had come here and celebrated their own cultural identity, it would be much easier for them to affirm cultural pluralism and ethnic pluralism and other people's gifts that they bring to the table today. But having lost that for themselves, it becomes much more difficult to appreciate that in somebody else. And the key component of that is language.
Yes.
And once we give up language, we lose everything that connects us back to that place.
Because you lose the stories.
Right.
Yeah, you lose the stories.
And so yay for people who are multilingual.
Right, right.
Rather than who give up everything to only speak English and lose their sense of individuality and the gifts that they bring as a people.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you there very much. I have a Cuban-American neighbor who, of course, speaks very good Spanish, having been born and raised in Cuba. But he doesn't teach his children Spanish. And my wife, for instance, is a Spanish teacher and is bilingual by you know, enormous efforts on her part to get a bachelor's and to live in Madrid a year and to covenant not to speak English for at least a year, helped her jump the American educational gap and actually become bilingual. And, you know, but I can't tell this man how to run his household. So my son plays with his boys, and they don't speak Spanish any better than my son does, who's learning Spanish pretty well. And I think that, to me, I see that as a tragedy. That's their choice, of course. But it seems to me that particular family is concerned really about fitting in. They don't look typically Hispanic, you know, they're the kind, in terms of their phenotype. If they have no Spanish accents, you know, his children would not necessarily, in a lineup, be say, oh yeah, those folks are Hispanic. And I think there's that urge in them, they want to fit in, which is, of course, they're right. It's a free country.
I have a real good friend who came to this country in 1960. He's Kikuyu. He came from a little village outside of Nairobi. Speaks fluent English today. He only speaks to his children in Swahili. And so his children grow up being bilingual. When they go to visit his family in Kenya, they can talk with the family.
Sure. Well, I think that to me is the ideal model.
Yeah.
Not my friends, but it's a free country. Yeah.
Well, that's what some of our immigrants took on, is the pride of wanting to become an American. My father immigrated from Denmark, and boy, we never heard a word of Danish in our family because he was here to, he had pride about his inheritance and what he was going to become, and you know, that he was going to be an American. He left his country, you know, so to speak.
Yeah.
And now then we got the Southeast Asia contingent coming in, and you know, they're creating a cultural barrier too.
They're creating a cultural barrier, or they're bringing their culture,
their culture,
which is not
with them, and it's creating
tension. Well, I mean, I understand that.
You know, we can't just blame people to the south of us, you know.
Yeah, I see your point. This gentleman and then this gentleman.
I was just going to comment on both the comment that you just made and what she was talking about earlier with the communities having an influx of different nationalities. We have, in Tacoma, we have a predominantly Mexican area, and then we have a predominantly Korean, Asian area. And you see a lot of times the adults, it kind of fits in with what you said when your wife had to go for a year and spend a whole year not speaking English in order to become bilingual. I think that the older parents, they're so used to their traditional ways. I see a lot of times when children, they bring their children with them when they go to buy something.
Right.
So the children can interpret for them because if they're over here only for a year or so, it's very hard for them even taking these classes to learn the English language because of all the differentiations between speaking it. So they have them interpret it. That way it takes longer for them to learn it, and they're not as mobile in the community because they don't fit in. They don't have a good grasp on
sure.
the language.
Sure.
So I think that also puts them away from everybody else. And I know that they kind of have one little community so they can get support from each other in their community, start businesses up, and they just get a community support until they can get start dispersing. I think that's how they fit in. They're going to start fitting in because the children are going to school and learning the language. They'll bring that home and take it through the community. But I think bilingualism is a great thing. I think everybody should probably know another language.
Sure, sure. So. And that used to be the standard for the educated person.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes, I know in my case, my grandparents came from Norway. And my parents spoke Norwegian in their home. But in our family, they didn't teach us Norwegian because they didn't want us to have that Norwegian accent. And I think that happens with a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that was the old melting pot theory. And what we really find is that America really is more of a Greek salad than a stew. That, in fact, you know, you do have discernible ethnic identities. That maybe the salad dressing should be English. Okay.
Yeah, if we don't have
you see
English
what I'm
as a national language, you're going to end up in the mess they got in Canada. Mm-hmm. They got to label everything in both English and French up there.
Yeah, but again, though, that history is that the French and the English got there, you know. I think the French might have even, with Champlain and others may have gotten there first. I don't know. But, I mean, it was fairly close in time. This gentleman, I believe you have?
If a person has cancer, often for a long time, they're only aware of minor symptoms. Is this prejudice and use of cultures and so forth to discount and put down other people's, and when that's almost accepted within our church circles. Is that like a symptom of a much deeper cancer in our church?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, and we're just about out of time, so perhaps I can close on some of my remembrances and remarks on that. When I grew up in the Presbyterian Church in New Jersey, I'm a Disciple of Christ minister, but I grew up Presbyterian. We had 13 African-American Presbyterian churches in the Newark Presbytery, and I remember seeing, I was very young, you know, some of these newsreels. We didn't have VCRs in those days, and you'd see all this concern about missionary work being disrupted in Africa, and in particular in Kenya, in which those terrible Mau Maus, including Jomo Kenyatta, were disrupting the British government's benign rule of Kenya. And of course, by the time I grew up, you know, we saw newsreels of Queen Elizabeth, you know, shaking Jomo Kenyatta's hand, who's now the Prime Minister of Kenya. And we've seen that much more recently with Nelson Mandela. Namely, that the kind of racism that we've had in the church has only been given up reluctantly. It's there at the core, which is why, indeed, of all our societies or institutions that lack integration, the church leads the way, generally. And in fact, I'll probably close on this note, in terms of white flight, that is, you know, European Americans getting panicky because their neighborhood seems to be changing in terms of its color, ethnicity, or whatever, that oftentimes will begin first in the church. You know, in terms of my own historical experience, the black church I grew up in initially was not an African-American Presbyterian church. We were like the fourth family there. And everything went well until about the eighth or ninth family went there. At which point our brothers and sisters in the faith decided that suburban New Jersey Presbyterian churches were also much more attractive. And so there was white flight, at which point that became the 14th African-American Presbyterian church in the Newark Presbytery. And so the church really is at the forefront of a kind of benighted understanding of human nature. Not, the church has been more of the problem, really, than the solution. And it's odd because the church has had, even from the time I was useless, the rhetoric in terms of formal doctrine that Christ died for everybody. But in terms of actual practice, I have heard very few, if any, sermons that said, well, so what, that Hispanics are moving into our neighborhood or African Americans are moving in. You shouldn't panic. You shouldn't assume that your housing values would automatically go down. Or if your son or daughter brings a black friend home, that's not the end of the world. But, you know, in terms of theoretical doctrine, you would think you'd hear practical sermons to that effect, but it never moves from the theoretical doctrine to actually how do we welcome people into our community. One of the things I'd like, I'm on the board of Holden, one of the things I would like at Holden is for us to be more intentional about relating to Manson and relating to Hispanics. I mean, that may be a great opportunity for Lutheranism. And if not for Lutheranism, at least spiritual development, Christian spiritual development, so that even this community could look differently if people, by the power of the Holy Spirit, move towards us. And I guess that was the last remark. Thank you for your attention.